It's hard to believe that this day, September 18th, marks the 50th anniversary of CBS Radio. For most of us, CBS is an institution that seems always to have been here. But 50 years ago today, it all began. For the next 3 hours, we're going to take a look back at that beginning and at the days and years between to recall some of the highlights of CBS Radio's first 50 years. And we'll begin in a moment.
And now, Bill Schallert with an opening word from General Electric.
Tonight's messages from General Electric will take you on a tour of some interesting places in our country and try to tell you something. Something of the progress GE has made in fields like medicine, communications, aviation, power generation, and home appliances. And you might keep this in mind as you listen. Where progress has been made in the past, it's likely to be made in the future. So GE expects to keep right on making progress. Progress for people from General Electric.
Now, CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound. Here is CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite.
The first sound on the CBS radio network was music. And it was music that dominated CBS programming for the next three decades. The year 1927 was the beginning of it all. A new network called the Columbia Phonograph Broadcasting System, later shortened to the Columbia Broadcasting System, made its debut on the air. Life in America appeared carefree, even madcap then. It was the era of the flapper, the speakeasy, jazz. New York was the entertainment capital of the nation and the center of a new industry called broadcasting. And here is one of the hit tunes CBS Radio was playing that year. Radio's musical repertoire also included classical music. CBS Radio had its own symphony orchestra from the beginning. In 1927, it was under the direction of Howard Barlow. Later, it was led by such distinguished guest conductors as Alfredo Antonini and Bernard Herrmann. On this day, exactly 50 years ago, the CBS Radio Network debuted with a six-hour program of musical variety. The highlight was an American opera by Deems Taylor called The King's Henchman, featuring cast members from the Metropolitan Opera. Unfortunately, the original air production was not recorded. Taping was a thing of the future. But here is a 1942 recording of that opera with Deems Taylor narrating, just as he had done on that first CBS day. Lawrence Tibbett is heard singing the lead.
It is nearly time for Athelwold to start on his journey. He and the king exchange pledges of eternal brotherhood. His horse is led to the door. And now Macus, Athelwold's man-at-arms, who is to accompany him on his mission, springs to his feet and leads the crowd in an old Saxon drinking song, in which he is joined by Edgar and Athelwold.
See the great was Bob, and Julius was thy name.
Oh, we can ring the bell, and Julius was thy name.
That put thy way through fellow scrims, saw me print and came.
But
I was not can I dare. Anybody quick and dare.
The next year, 1928, a young man named William S. Paley of Philadelphia bought controlling interest in the Columbia Network. Hardly a network at all by today's standards, only 16 stations. As he told a CBS News producer in an interview for this broadcast, Paley came to New York with something specific in mind for the new network.
The first thing I had to do when I got over here was to organize the company and to change the program schedule altogether. We were getting no place with what we had, and start to build an organization, which, funnily enough, was not very easy to do. My friends, for instance, in Philadelphia, thought I was crazy. They thought this radio was a sort of a passing fancy. And when I got to New York, I had difficulty hiring people. I didn't sit down and say, this isn't my program for radio as to what I think it ought to become. But I got educated to its potentials and little by little started to evolve a philosophy and a plan. In those days, nobody was making radio sets. There were no brand names. If you wanted one, you had to get a hold of a technician who knew how to put one together. And that's what I did, and I bought my first crystal set. And then would sit around until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning trying to get KDKA in Pittsburgh. And there was a station in Kansas City, I think I got once or twice, which is very exciting. But even before I got into it as a business, I saw it as a bit of magic, as a medium that was able, I thought, at some future time to communicate with all the people in the country and all the people in the world. And what a fantastic thing this was.
Under William Paley's hand in the next decade, the 1930s, CBS programming came into its own. Through the 1930s, dance bands were an important feature of evening and weekend radio listening. One of the biggest and most famous bands of the era was Paul Whiteman's orchestra. And among Whiteman's early vocalists was a young man named Bing Crosby, who had first been featured as one of a trio calling itself the Rhythm Boys. Paley heard Crosby on a recording one day and offered him a show of his own on the network in 1931.
Ain't so, honey, ain't so. Spoke to the Lord and the Lord said, no, ain't so.
Honey, ain't so.
Ain't so, honey, ain't so. The devil said yes, but the Lord said, no, ain't so.
Honey, ain't so.
Dance music was a boon for those with no money to spend on entertainment during the Depression. Going to nightclubs and buying records were for the rich. John Hammond, an executive with Columbia Records then and long associated with CBS, recalls how much dance band music was heard on the radio then and on into the 1940s.
All radio stations in those days had house bands, unlike what we have today, you know, where there is no live music. There were remotes, you know, from practically all the nightclubs in New York.
Thank you.
Lance Lohman, CBS Vice President of Personnel before his retirement, also came to New York from Philadelphia at the request of William Paley to work in the new enterprise. Lohman recalls those early days.
One of the first trial and error periods for broadcasting in general was pressures from labor unions and how to handle them, and in particular from the musicians' union, who were very strongly led by Petrillo. At one point, in negotiations in the 30s, I went to see him. And he met me at the train. We talked on many occasions. In an armored car, it was during the rough 30s. And a car rode ahead with the armed men. He was somewhat fearful, I presume, of his own situation. Certainly no concern of his as to mine. And I found out after he just had done it as kind of a gag. He thought it would be maybe impressive, but more than that, that it'd have influence for the negotiations that were to come.
The Benny Goodman Quartet was heard regularly on CBS, and eventually Goodman had his own program called Benny Goodman's Swing School, a quartet where Goodman himself, Lionel Hampton, and Gene Krupa, with Teddy Wilson at the piano.
Teddy Wilson is the first Negro to be hired, in my recollection, on any basis of our thinking in terms of doing something about blacks. And we were aware of the problem and wondering about how to best go about it, but not terribly intelligent. It was John Hammond who first called me and said, "You know that you don't have one black man in your orchestra." And I said, "What do you suggest?" He said, "Well, I get just a few, certainly start with one very good one. I think I could get Teddy Wilson." So we put Teddy Wilson on, and from that, we sort of eased into the business of thinking in terms of doing much more about Negroes.
I can't give you anything but love, baby. That's the only thing I've plenty of, baby. Dream a while, scheme a while, you're sure to find happiness. And I guess, for all those things you always pine for, gee, I'd like to see you looking swell. Maybe diamond bracelets, Woolworth doesn't sell. Baby, till that lucky day, I know darn well. Baby, I can give you anything but love.
The Mills Brothers hitchhiked to New York from Cincinnati in 1932, auditioned for Columbia, and were promptly put under contract. As the 1930s drew to a close, a world war was about to erupt in Europe. The years to come were important years of development for music on CBS Radio, and we'll turn to them next.
You are listening to CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound. And now Bill Schallert for General Electric.
What we call radio today is nothing at all like what radio used to be. Back around the turn of the century, radio was not the sound of the human voice. Radio was nothing but dots and dashes. Morse code, that's all that radio could send out. But in 1906, something happened that changed all that. It happened in a little Massachusetts town on the Atlantic coast, Brant Rock. And if you stand on the beach in Brant Rock today, it's not hard to look out over the ocean and imagine just how exciting that event must have been. Christmas Eve, 1906. Out on the Atlantic, ship's wireless operators were doing what they always did, listening to the dots and dashes that flew through the air. Then, suddenly, their earphones were filled not with the sounds of dots and dashes, but the sound of a human voice. What they were hearing was the very first long-distance radio broadcast of the human voice, the voice of Dr. R. Fessenden. It came from an antenna in Brant Rock. And one of the men who made it possible was a General Electric engineer named Ernst Alexanderson. Working up at the General Electric Labs in Schenectady, Alexanderson had developed a device called the high-frequency alternator. It was Alexanderson's alternator that first helped send the human voice out into the air. Today, airwaves are full of the human voice. The police, aviators, astronauts, people like me on programs like this. In fact, broadcasting has become so commonplace that you can broadcast your own voice from your own car or your own home. No, radio is nothing at all like what radio used to be. And the progress that's been made, from early wireless to today's sophisticated equipment, well, General Electric had quite a hand in that. Progress for people from General Electric.
Continuing with the first of 3 hours of our CBS News special broadcast, CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, here is correspondent Walter Cronkite reporting on music in the life of CBS Radio. Frank Stanton, president of CBS for 25 of its most crucial years before he retired, remembers the impact of the war on CBS, not just its musical programming, but entertainment programming in general.
I suppose that the radio network really came into its own after World War II, when we went very heavily into doing our own programs. Up until that time, almost all of the programs in the schedule were produced by outside organizations, bought by the advertiser, delivered to us by the advertising agency, and the advertiser was really in control of the schedule. When Mr. Paley came back from the war, he seized that opportunity to embark upon the development of our own programs, which would be owned by the company and sold to the advertiser. With that one concept and the implementation of it, network radio changed from an advertiser-dominated medium to a broadcaster-dominated medium.
The war years made radio even more valuable to its listeners, not only for information about the war, but for its entertainment, especially popular music, which kept morale high. A regular in the war years was
the music of Andre Castellano. Tonight we present Fiesta, a Latin American musical fantasy. We're on our way. Here's Malagueña, as Andre Castellanet sees it.
Another popular program was your hit parade, which the Columbia Network recreated in Spanish for broadcast to Latin America by its shortwave network, which it established in 1940.
Y finalmente, nuestra campeona suprema en el desfile de las canciones campeonas del momento popular. Con nuestra primera estrella al micrófono, la sin par Joan Edwards, escuchemos la canción que esta semana vuelve a ocupar por el aplauso unánime de la juventud norteamericana, el primer puesto del hit parade. El amor lo puede todo. Oh, what it seemed to be.
It was just a neighborhood dance. That's all that it was. But oh, what it seemed to be. It was like a royal affair with everyone there. 'Cause you said, yes, I do.
Para toda América Latina, el original Hit Parade volverá al aire de hoy en 8 días con sus artistas de costumbre. Joan Edwards, Joe Dosh, los Hit Paraders, Johnny Mercer y la orquesta del maestro Mark Warno. Y al micrófono, su amigo de siempre, José Santos Quijano. Por la libertad y solidaridad continental, la cadena de las Américas, Columbia Broadcasting System.
Other CBS musical headliners then and after the war as well were the orchestras of Glenn Miller, Guy Lombardo, Wayne King, and Vaughn Monroe, the Dorsey Brothers, and Woody Herman. There also was Spike Jones, whose orchestra had an entirely different sound. Popular singers also were featured in these years with programs of their own, among them a newcomer who was the idol of the Bobby Sox set. They swooned whenever he sang. His name, Frank Sinatra. And here he is with the Andrews sisters, Patty, Maxine, and Laverne, in a CBS broadcast called Songs by Sinatra.
That's me. Neighbors, you're probably not planning a trip to New York in the very near future, at least, so the Andrews sisters and I would like to give you a rapid look-see at life on the stage of the Paramount Theater. Girls, the overture.
Here we are at the Paramount, 44th and Broadway, more shows than we can count.
You can say that again.
More shows than we can count.
Yes, sir. That schedule at the Paramount is mighty rugged. So you wander out on the stage and you start moaning. Kiss me once, and kiss me twice, and kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time.
But never a long, long time between shows. Right, Laverne?
I'll say so, Maxie. By noon, I'm so worn out that I feel like an old mop.
Well, you sure got the hair for it.
I stepped out on the wings expecting the giant spotlight. Nobody even lit a match. The Andrews sisters, were still on stage. They had been there all night giving encores.
Do you hear that whistle down the line? I think that is engine number 49. She's in her game. I'm glad I found that way. On the accident to begin the Santa Fe.
Hey, spotlight, hey. Okay, so I'll sing it in the dark.
I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast.
We have the right atmosphere here, you notice?
No kidding.
I fall in love.
That sounds like Frankie Sinatra.
Terribly hard.
Why,
fall up to ever.
And I, Laverne, looking as radiant as a radiator.
Say, Frankie, what songs are you going to be doing?
Well, maybe things like The One I Love Belongs to Somebody Else. That's why she sings her songs for somebody else.
Frankie, are you going to do any of those swell tunes from How Many Times Have You Seen Anchors Away?
Well, I thought I might do I pleaded.
But I, Laverne, played hard to get.
You mean hard to get rid of.
But, Frankie, getting back to reality, I thought we got out of that mix-up pretty gracefully, didn't you?
Well, naturally, I dressed up like the Fourth Andrews Sisters. We did a buck and wing and shuffled off the Paramount stage singing. If you're hot beneath the collar, go down, see my sponsor.
My mother's three daughters working for the Yankee Dollar.
If you don't mind, we'll run along, but we'll be back to sing a song.
Sinatra, he will sing real sweet,
while you three birds go
tweet, tweet, tweet. We love our sponsors.
Yankee Dollar.
From the beginning, CBS programming included serious music, chamber and church music, symphonies and grand opera, and a program called Invitation to Music, which featured original compositions. But perhaps the most remembered were broadcasts of the New York Philharmonic, heard Sunday afternoons from 1930 to music, all kinds of music, has been an integral part of CBS radio programming from the start and remains so today with such continuing broadcasts as the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. But in recent years, the emphasis has shifted to news and informational programming. We'll have our first look at that next.
You are listening to CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound. And now Bill Schallert for General Electric.
If you'd like to take a short walk through an exciting piece of the past, a good place to do it is in Speedway, Indiana. Out by the racetrack, where they run the 500-mile race every Memorial Day, is the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Hall of Fame. It's not just a museum of old race cars. It's really a museum of advanced engineering. Because each year, the cars designed for the Indy race represent the absolute limits of engineering at that time. No money or brains or time are spared to put together what the builders hope will be that year's winning car. In 1925, the winning car was a Duesenberg. That car's in pieces now, waiting to be restored and put on display in the Indy Museum. And when it is, you'll be able to see the device that helped it win, a supercharger built by General Electric. Funny thing, that supercharger wasn't designed for a race car at all. It was designed a few years earlier to set another kind of record, an aviation altitude record. And it succeeded. Took a plane up to what was then the amazing height of 34,000 feet and made aviation history. Around the same time, GE came up with some other remarkable aircraft equipment, like a radio altimeter that used radio waves to tell pilots how high the plane was, and the electric compass, a device that could actually help fly the plane. Today, GE's contribution is even more spectacular. The mighty GE CF6 jet engine now powers airlines in some 29 nations and is setting records for economy and efficiency. It's odd that the supercharger, which once set records in the air, should come to rest in a museum dedicated to records on the ground. But good engineering is seldom limited to any one place or any one use. It's needed wherever people want to make progress. Progress for People from General Electric. You are listening to CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, a special CBS News broadcast. CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite continues with the first of 3 hours of this anniversary special.
In 1927, when network broadcasting first began at the Columbia Broadcasting System, the majority of its programming was entertainment, much of it a wide variety of music, as we've heard. But in 1930, a newspaper man named Edward Klauber from the New York Times was hired to guide in the development of journalism at Columbia Broadcasting. The election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1932 was the first big news event covered by radio.
This is Robert Trout at our election headquarters in the newsroom in New York. The results of the 1932 election now appear to be certain. The ticket of Roosevelt and Garner has won a clear-cut majority over the Republican ticket of Hoover and
Curtis. That night in 1932, radio broadcast the election returns and scooped the newspapers reporting Roosevelt's victory. At that moment, the newspaper extra became an anachronism, as CBS's first news director, the late Paul White, is quoted as saying. But that first on radio triggered a radio press war, a dispute that cut all radio networks off from the use of the press wire services for the next 2 years. William Dunn, today a public relations executive, was writing and editing Columbia's air copy then, and he remembers the radio press war.
Back in the early 30s, the press associations refused to sell news to us. They just wouldn't let us in on the thing. So White, Abe Schechter, and several others like that got together and organized their own news service. And CBS had a pretty fair little news service going with correspondents in Washington, Chicago, several of the key places. It was effective enough that the press associations got worried. So they agreed to set up an outfit called Press Radio News, which all the press associations contributed to, and they furnished the networks with a certain amount of canned news every day.
In 1933, General Mills agreed to sponsor the Columbia News Service, and within a month, CBS had some 600 correspondents and stringers covering the news in major American cities, but not yet overseas. And then the first regularly scheduled daily newscasts began. 5 minutes at noon and at 4:30 in the afternoon, and 15 minutes at 11 in the evening. By the close of the decade, Robert Trout and the late H.V. Kaltenborn were well-known broadcast news analysts on CBS Radio, Trout reporting from Washington on the new president and his new deal. Recently, Trout, who now lives in Spain, recalled President Roosevelt's first fireside chat for CBS News.
After the March 4th inauguration, the banks were closed. The country seemed to be in a rather bad way. Lots and lots of people were terribly depressed. Everybody was worried. People were questioning. Nobody knew what was going to happen. It was really a rather touchy time. And the president announced that he was going to make a talk from the White House to explain just what was going on and why the banks were closed and why nobody could cash a check and why, even if you had a job, you probably didn't have any money to eat on. The White House just said that there was to be a talk by the president. So at the CBS Washington offices, we prepared two introductions for me to use to put the president on the air. The man who actually thought of the phrase fireside chat was Harry Butcher, who at that time was the director and the general manager of CBS's Washington station. It was his idea that this would be just the kind of folksy touch that might do for the introduction for the president. And the whole little introduction was about the president is going to talk to you just as if he had come into your home and sat down beside the fireplace in your living room and gave a sort of fireside chat. It was that kind of introduction. So we sent both introductions over to the White House for the president to choose, and a little while later, Marvin McIntyre, the president's secretary, telephoned Harry Butcher and said, oh, the president likes that folksy one, and so I used it.
H.V. Kaltenborn, like many others in the early days, had been a print journalist before coming to CBS.
Good evening, everybody. There has been a contest of wits between the president of the United States.
Known as the dean of radio news analysts, Kaltenborn gained a national reputation for his round-the-clock reports of the Munich crisis in September of 1938, following the annexation of Austria in March, another radio news event.
All over, wherever you went, you saw people carrying radios because they were listening to the crisis and didn't want to lose a minute of it. That for the first time, the entire country was aware of the fact that the actions of one of these dictators operating over there in Europe could plunge this country into a world war.
The annexation of Austria not only changed the course of world politics, but changed the coverage of news as well. Ned Kalmer, a writer and a CBS newsman for almost 30 years before his retirement, remembers.
To cover that story, CBS put together the first World News Roundup, which I later anchored in New York, with hastily hired correspondents in London, Paris, Berlin, Rome, and Washington. And from then on, CBS radio news just grew and grew, outgrowing the broadcast pattern that required mellow-toned announcers to read the news, and in their place put men who knew what they were talking about, wrote their own scripts, ad-libbed knowledgeably when necessary, were ready to go on the air in emergencies with the requisite background to analyze and explain the situation, whatever it might be.
CBS News Director Paul White was one of the first at Columbia Broadcasting to foresee the need for building a more extensive news operation to cover the story of the century, as some called it, that was about to engulf the world. In 1937, he'd sent Edward R. Murrow to London and later sent William Dunn to the Pacific.
White was convinced that we were just one step ahead of a war in the Pacific, and nobody was doing anything about it. He said, "Bill, I want you to go to the Far East for us." And I went out and I set up correspondents in Manila, in Hong Kong, Tokyo, Chongqing, Singapore, Batavia. I think that was it.
In Europe, Ed Murrow, who was named CBS's European director, did the same. Again, Ned Calmer.
As war broke and spread to the world, Ed put together the famous European staff of war correspondents who came to be known in the trade as the Murrow Boys and included Charles Collingwood, Eric Severide, Howard Smith, Bill Downs, Larry Lesueur, and later such names as Winston Burdett, Alex Kendrick, David Schoenbrunn.
At home, newsmen H.V. Kaltenborn and Robert Trout, along with John Daly, Quincy Howe, and Quentin Reynolds, reported and analyzed events of the time. One among them was unsurpassed when it came to writing analyses, some of the briefest and most brilliant, Calmer says, he ever heard. His name was Elmer Davis.
I have striking recollections of Elmer at 485 Madison, his total serenity when all hell was breaking loose in the newsroom, and the way he used to sit calmly in a corner waiting to go on the air while reading the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Whatever the terms imposed on France may be, it can pretty safely be assumed that they will be such as to make it impossible for France ever to become dangerous to Germany again, unless, of course, Hitler should be overthrown. How much farther they may go in the direction of attempting to make France over on the Nazi model remains to be seen, but at least some of the Nazi theorists seem to have extensive hopes. One of the chief of these philosophers of Nazism, a man who has worked out its doctrines very thoroughly, is Alfred Rosenberg. He's a less prominent figure than he used to be, but he still writes a good deal in the Völkischer Beobachter, the principal Nazi paper, and some remarks of his quoted in the New York Times last Sunday are a suggestion of the sort of world that the more philosophical Nazis will create if they can. Mr. Rosenberg writes about Paris. "The fall of Paris," he says, I quote, "the fall of Paris is the beginning of the end of the spiritual and racial turpitude of Europe. For Paris was the center of the mental confusion that pervaded Europe," end quote. What Rosenberg and the other Nazis call mental confusion, and they mean this quite sincerely, it's part of a well-thought-out philosophy, what they call mental confusion is what the rest of us call freedom of thought, the liberty of the mind to work over everything and come to its own conclusions.
Eric Severide covered the fall of Paris.
The life just simply ran out of the city. It was like a beautiful woman lying in a coma, you know, with her lifeblood just draining out from every vein, every street.
And William L. Shirer, the French surrender to Hitler.
"The Frenchman entered Marshal Foch's Pullman car, standing there a few feet from us in Compiègne Forest. Hitler and the other German leaders rise from their feet as the French enter the drawing room. Hitler, we see, gives the Nazi salute."
The surrender took place in the same Pullman car in which the Germans had surrendered to the Allies in World War I. In 1941, the United States entered the war. CBS had 65 correspondents covering Europe, Asia, and Latin America, reporting mostly by shortwave. In the first year of the war, Columbia operated for more than 6,000 hours and provided over 4,000 broadcasts of war news and analyses. Here's how some of those wartime reports sounded. First, Elmer Davis, and then Robert Trout.
"Great Britain went to war against Germany today. 25 years and 30 days from the time she entered the War of 1914 against the same enemy. France is expected to follow suit within the next few hours.
Great Britain has begun the evacuation of its mothers and children, its cripples and its blind. 3 million of those too weak to fight or to help are being moved from the so-called target areas of the large cities to sanctuaries in the British countryside. It is the greatest mass migration in all history. Now, to give you a first-hand account of this evacuation, Columbia calls in London and hears from Mr. Joly de Lobigné, head of the outside broadcast department of the British Broadcasting Corporation. We take you now to London.
But on number 12 platform at Waterloo Station, one of the 10 big metropolitan stations that are engaged today on the evacuation of London's school children. The train's in and the children are just arriving. I'd like to try and find one of the teachers who's going with them.
Yes.
Are you going with them?
Yes.
Tell us now how many you've got to look after here.
I've got 141 children and 16 people helping. They've come from one of the poorest districts in London, very near the famous Elephant and Castle, which no doubt many people have heard. They're all merry and bright. We haven't had a single child crying. And now I think really in my heart they're looking forward to this little adventure because many of them have never seen the country before. We're very grateful for all that's been done for us. And to all those who've helped us, we say thank you from the bottom of our heart.
1 minute, the train's leaving in 1 minute, is it? Well, now, children, come on, give them a song as you go.
Come on now.
The war spread. Pearl Harbor was attacked by Japan, bringing the United States into the war. Hitler fought on two fronts, west toward England and east into Russia. There were two turning points. The Battle of the Bulge, a last-ditch attempt by the Germans to stop the Allied advance in Europe in 1944, along with the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Japan, the next year. First, Richard C. Hodlitz reported the Battle of the Bulge in Belgium.
It's icy cold on the front tonight, and the mud on the roads and in the fields is frozen hard in wrinkles and folds. The men, digging new positions in the fields, have had to chop at the ground with their shovels and use axes. And over all, over ruined buildings and corpses and the wrecks of tanks and trucks, over everything, this late December chill has thrown a patina of frost. Out in the forward position, men are lying in holes, beating their hands together, stamping their feet to get warm. And the ones who are in houses and cellars with stoves and something to burn know how lucky they are. It's mainly behind the line that you realize we're building up for one of the greatest battles to be fought on any front in this war. The men on our front are completely alert. Guns are at the ready with shells half rammed into their breeches. They're waiting for the German attack, the next big attack.
When we saw what had happened. What had been Hiroshima was a white mountain of smoke, and when we saw it first, it was already up to 25,000 feet. About 1,000 feet off the ground, it looked like boiling dust. It extended over most of the city, churning down there. And the center of the impact was in the center of the city. And the boiling continued several minutes as we watched. Then the mushroom of smoke broke off, and another developed below it. This one bomb is the equivalent of a 2,000 B-29 raid. This is Webley Edwards at Guam. I return you to New York.
After 6 long years, hostilities ended and the Germans and Japanese surrendered. Charles Collingwood and Robert Trout covered those events.
About 2:30 in the morning, General Tui Spatz walks in. He is followed in quick succession by the Russians. Then Air Marshal Robb comes in, Admiral Burrow. Pretty soon, Beadle Smith himself enters, the man who bore the brunt of the long hours of negotiation. Then the Germans come in. Jodl's face is like a death mask, drawn, unnatural looking, and with every muscle in it clenched. They reach the table, bow in unison, and wait. General Smith motions them to sit down. Everyone sits down. Jodl signs the surrender at 2:41, and then General Smith, who hands it to the Russian General Soslaparov, and finally the French General Seves, signs it. By 2:45, the last signature has been affixed. Then came the most dramatic moment of all. Everything had been signed. There was no longer any possibility of quibbling or evasion. The German Third Reich, which had once made the world to tremble, had collapsed in blood-stained fragments. Colonel General Jodl, Chief of Staff of the German Army, asked General Beadle Smith's permission to speak. He stood up stiffly, like a man holding himself in against some unbearable pain. in a strangled voice, like a sob, he said, "With this signature, the German people and the German armed forces are, for better or worse, delivered into the victor's hands. In this hour, I can only express the hope that the victor will treat them with generosity." When General Jodl sat down after that, it was all over.
7 p.m. Eastern Wartime, Bob Trout reporting. The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That's the word we've just received from the White House in Washington. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War. The United Nations, on land, on the sea, in the air, and to the four corners of the earth, are united and are victorious.
No history of CBS News could be complete without its most notable war correspondent, the late Edward R. Murrow.
This is London. History has been made too fast over here today. First, in the early hours this morning, came the news of the British unopposed...
His reports from London in the war years, from places such as the liberated Buchenwald concentration camp, are considered masterpieces of radio journalism.
As I walked down to the end of the barracks, there was applause from the men too weak to get out of bed. It sounded like the hand clapping of babies. As we walked out into the courtyard, a man fell dead. Two others, they must have been over 60, were crawling towards the latrine. I saw it, but will not describe it. In another part of the camp, they showed me the children, hundreds of them. Some were only six. One rolled up his sleeve, showed me his number. It was tattooed on his arm. D-6030 it was. The others showed me their numbers. They will carry them till they die. The children clung to my hands and stared. We crossed to the courtyard. Men kept coming up to speak to me and to touch me. Professors from Poland, doctors from Vienna, men from all Europe. Men from the countries that made America. We proceeded to the small courtyard. There were two rows of bodies stacked up like cordwood. They were thin and very white. Some of the bodies were terribly bruised, though there seemed to be little flesh to bruise. Some had been shot through the head, but they bled but little. It appeared that most of the men and boys had died of starvation. They had not been executed. But the manner of death seemed unimportant. Murder had been done at Buchenwald. I have reported what I saw and heard, but only part of it. If I have offended you by this rather mild account of Buchenwald, I am not in the least sorry.
I teach my students by using some of Murrow's broadcasts. He was an original. Combination, though, of being able to hold an audience, be serious, never see his likes again.
Fred W. Friendly, former CBS News president, longtime colleague of Murrow, and producer for many Murrow broadcasts. After the war, Murrow came home to find that a hot war had turned to a cold one. In the 1950s, he focused on the late Republican senator from Wisconsin, Joseph McCarthy. One of Murrow's reports about McCarthy underscored the cross currents of feeling in the country in those days.
No one familiar with the history of his country can deny that congressional committees are useful. It is necessary to investigate before legislating. But the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and the junior senator from Wisconsin has stepped over it repeatedly. His primary achievement has been in confusing the public mind as between the internal and the external threats of communism. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine and remember that we are not descended from fearful men. Not from men who feared to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes that were for the moment unpopular. This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent, or for those who approve. We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the result. There is no way for a citizen of a republic to abdicate his responsibilities. As a nation, we have come into our full inheritance at a tender age. We proclaim ourselves, as indeed we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world. But we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home. The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night, and good luck.
The post-war period brought Harry S. Truman to the White House after the death of Franklin Roosevelt in April of 1945. Truman tried to hammer out the principles of a lasting peace with other major powers, but peace proved elusive. Russia and the Western powers were in constant friction as to where their spheres of influence began and ended. Some called it a conflict of interest between two opposing systems. In 1946, Winston Churchill, Britain's wartime prime minister, described the Russian post-war behavior in this famous passage in a speech broadcast on CBS radio and delivered in Fulton, Missouri.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all our subjects, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing measure of control from Moscow. Whatever conclusions may be drawn from these facts, in fact they are, this is certainly not the liberated Europe we fought to build up, nor is it one which contains the essentials of permanent peace.
President Truman fought back with the Truman Doctrine, a doctrine that established a pattern for U.S. foreign policy lasting a generation. In 1947, the Truman Doctrine called for the United States to pump $400 million in economic and military aid to governments threatened with communist takeover.
I believe that we must assist free peoples to work out their own destinies in their own way. This is a serious course upon which we embark. I would not recommend it, except that the alternative is much more serious.
A few months later, the Marshall Plan was instituted, an unprecedented aid program designed to restore the economies of European countries devastated by the war. By 1948, the Cold War was in high gear, and it was reported in all its aspects, domestic and foreign, by CBS News. The Russians blockaded Berlin, isolating that capital city from the West, and for 328 days, the Allies flew in food and material to the partitioned city. In 1949, the Soviets developed their own atomic bomb, and the dispute between East and West deepened. In 1950, the United States was involved in war again, limited war, but war nevertheless. Soviet-trained troops from North Korea attacked South Korea, and United Nations troops, 90% of them Americans, were dispatched by President Truman to go overseas to fight again. It was a new war in a new place, reported on CBS radio, and a new generation of correspondents. George Herman, Robert Pierpoint, Robert Shackney, Dallas Townsend, and others. General Douglas MacArthur was put in charge of the Korean campaign and urged the president to take the fight north into China itself. Mr. Truman declined, fearing that this action could start World War III, and MacArthur expressed his dissent in public. He was fired by the president. When MacArthur returned to this country, he addressed a joint session of the Congress in a moving speech heard on CBS radio on April 19, 1951.
I am closing my 52 years of military service. When I joined the Army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times. since I took the oath on the plane at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye.
One noteworthy addition to the CBS News staff in these years was veteran news personality Lowell Thomas. In the late 40s, he returned to CBS, where he had started in 1930.
From Salisbury, Rhodesia, from Islamabad, Pakistan, and from Juneau, Alaska, comes today's news. Good evening, everybody. This is Lowell Thomas. At Louisville,
President... In 1976, after 46 years in broadcasting, Thomas retired. Lowell Thomas was listened to as much for what he said and the way he said it as for the news headlines he reported. His nightly newscast of 7 was the longest-running program of any kind on radio.
When I started and took Floyd Gibbons' place, I had all the air of the world to myself alone. Seems impossible. Both here and in the rest of the world, I had the only daily news broadcast anywhere in the world. Radio is just as potent as ever. It's... The form is a little bit different. Of course, radio doesn't have the monopoly that it had in those early years when I was on the air. But it still reaches out to the ends of the earth and is heard by billions and billions of people.
Radio went on, and so did the development of other aspects of CBS broadcasting. We'll continue the story shortly with a look at entertainment on CBS Radio. I'm Walter Cronkite, CBS News.